Good morning, diners and travelers. We're off to an adventure here on the menu. You're listening to Ann and Peter Haig talk about, in this program, I guess, a book, a fruit, and a book.
There you go. but it's not. They're not just books. No. They're books containing fascinating information, and
good
some
books.
And some tremendously capable authors. Whose views on the world of food and dining and restaurants and recipes you're sure to value. So shall we just jump right into it?
These are just absolutely fabulous writers, Andrew Dornenberg and Karen Page, and they've had so many hit books, but this one just about tops the list, I think.
Oh, I think so. I mean, we asked them how they could possibly gather all this information and during the interview, and you'll get an explanation of why, and maybe you'll have a suggestion about how you can organize your life, because it sounds like it would be generally a very useful idea anyway. But the Flavor Bible is a tremendous work, and everyone who's interested in flavor should have one.
It's actually an unusual experience for us to get a book that is a total wow, since we see so many books, but such is the case with the Flavor Bible. Pretty much what it says in its deck, the essential guide to culinary creativity based on the wisdom of America's most imaginative chefs, and it's not surprising that it's a book written by Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg, who have a string of successes on their hands and do a very, very fine job. Welcome to On the Menu.
Oh, thank you so much. We're
thank
delighted
you.
To be here.
Yeah, now, just briefly by background, Andrew, you are a trained chef. You're a chef by training.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
I worked in top restaurants in Boston and New York City, working with people like Chris Schlesinger of the East Coast Grill and Lydia Shire in Boston and Ann Rosenzweig and Wayne Nish here in New York.
Uh-huh. And Karen, you were a food writer.
Well, I came to my interest in food through, A, marrying a professional chef in Andrew back in 1990, and also through my work as a strategy consultant to Fortune 500 food and beverage companies.
All right, yes.
Product development.
I noticed you had an MBA in there somewhere, so before you got a real job.
If you want to put it that way, yes. I think some people might debate which is the real job, now or then.
Yeah, now I have to mention just quickly to Andrew, and Andrew got very shy. His voice was coming through loud and clear to begin with, and then all of a sudden when we went on air, he got shy.
So, okay, well, I'll speak up.
Andrew.
Good man. I have to give you credit for the most incredible effort in this book, because I don't understand how you could possibly have kept all these things in your heads.
It took 8 years.
You know, but after only a part of 8 years, I would start to lose that information. It would all leak.
Well, you know, that's the beauty of a database. I mean, I don't know what people did before databases.
Okay.
You try to keep it in your head. You pass it down through an oral tradition. Look at this combination of tomato and basil. It's a great combination. You should try it. And, you know, and these wonderful classic flavor combinations get codified into recipes that pass down through the generations. But now with the advent of so many different ingredients from around the world, I think the creativity that's being spurred is such a magnitude that you can't keep it straight unless you develop a database. So that's exactly what we started to do 8 years ago.
Okay, so you actually did you actually use the straight alphabetical A through Z based on telephone book at even though they were different things, so you'd have a food by a name and then something else, but it's a single index from A to Z?
Exactly. A to Z, we alphabetized it from apples to zucchini blossoms and everything in between. Any ingredient you could think of, any herb, spice, any oil, vinegar, salt, pepper, it's all in the book from A to Z, so that you can just look it up. If you have something in mind that you're cooking with, you look up that ingredient. It's organized like a dictionary or like a thesaurus, and then it's alphabetical, and you can find a listing of compatible flavors that will help to bring out the best of that ingredient, so that there's no guesswork involved. It's not like you can look at your spice shelf and say, oh, I've got this. I wonder if this will go with this particular dish I'm making or if it's going to ruin the whole thing. And in fact, that was really the genesis of the book, was when Andrew was a young experimental chef and we were living in Boston, and he would try some things that were a little off the wall, and usually I think he did pretty well. But
one night,
he was making this pot of Italian polenta, and he thought he'd flavor it in a different way, and he threw in some goat cheese, which sounded pretty good to me. I love goat cheese.
Yeah, I did too.
Then, yeah, he also threw in a handful of cilantro, or maybe a few handfuls of cilantro, which I also thought, you know, I love cilantro. Well, the combination together
was terrible.
Disgusting.
Exactly.
And we ended up having to get a whole batch of polenta out and, you know, go out for pizza. But the point was that this mistake really led us to the idea of, okay, there are obviously things that don't go together, flavor enemies, as we like to call them. What is the secret of understanding what flavors do go together? And that is, in fact, really the crux of what great cooking is all about. So that's what we set out to research.
So that's section 3 of the book. But sections 1 and 2 are really rather interesting. Section 1 and 2 are more sort of like philosophy than they are cooking itself, I guess. It just occurred to me that that was really what was included here, because there were some new things like the X factor.
Yeah.
And tapping body, heart, mind, and spirit, communicating via the language of food. I mean,
can you explain that
to our listeners?
Sure. Well, I think essentially we started out from ground zero with this book, and what Andrew and I set out to do was to create an ultimate cookbook that would be the most useful cookbook to anyone picking it up. And we had our own sense of what we wanted when it came to cooking in the kitchen. Andrew is a professional chef, and myself is an infrequent but enthusiastic cook, more when we go out to the country when I've got a big kitchen. It's a little bit more inspiring to me than on a day-to-day basis. Andrew really handles that in our relationship. We have a small Manhattan kitchen, as we like to say. There's only room for one ego in that kitchen, and it's not mine.
That would be mine, with all the burners on high.
No, Andrew does the cooking, but we wanted to start out and think, well, any, you know, experienced chef or any beginning chef, what is the most essential information you want at your fingertips if you're going to walk into the kitchen? And what that information includes is what cooking technique should you apply to a particular ingredient that you're working with? And number two, what herbs, spices, and other seasonings will best enhance the flavor of whatever it is you're cooking with? And as complicated as cooking can be, with all the cookbooks that exist and all the TV shows that exist giving you insight into the cooking process, really cooking can be really simple because it boils down to those two things, techniques and ingredients. And so in the Flavor Bible, we really wanted to focus in on what comprises deliciousness. And really, it does get down to flavor. But flavor isn't just about what's happening on your tongue, which is what we refer to as taste. When we talk about the four basic tastes of sweet, salty, sour, and bitter, and the importance of achieving a balance among those different tastes. And of course, there's also the taste of umami, which is called the fifth taste, and that refers to the sense of deliciousness, the sort of mouth-filling savoriness that you'll find in ingredients like Parmesan cheese or mushrooms or in the additive MSG, monosodium glutamate. But aside from taste, there's really other things that go into comprising flavor to add to deliciousness, and those include things like mouthfeel. You know, is the dish that you're eating hot or cold? Is it a vichyssoise? Is a cold potato soup, or is it a hot potato soup? You'll have very different experiences, even if it's made from the same potatoes and the same seasonings. So in addition to the temperature, you'll also have texture. And we're talking about a thick, chunky potato soup or a really thin, more broth-like potato soup. And those are very different experiences of the same potatoes. We also go into the idea of aroma, that it contributes as much as 80% or more to the experience of flavor.
You know, we had that experiment with Heston Blumenthal.
Yeah.
He had us taste an apple holding our nose.
And how? What was your experience
It didn't taste like an apple.
Bingo. What did it taste like to you?
I noticed mainly the texture.
Yeah, didn't really taste like anything. Now, two things puzzled me just a little bit, only because I didn't read every word in the book. When you get into the alphabetical section, you have season, I understand. You have taste, I understand. You have weight and volume. I mean, is it how loud is salsify?
Yes.
And how heavy is salsify?
That's exactly.
Yeah, that's pretty straightforward, rather.
Well, I'm not sure it is.
I don't think that this
is intuitively. It's not intuitively clear. It's not intuitively clear to me why it matters.
Exactly.
Whether the volume is moderate or low. I mean, do you even mean by
answer.
Volume?
We got into this whole exploration of weight and volume actually in our last book, What to Drink with What You Eat, when we realized how important it was to the whole idea of food and drink pairing to be able to address what the weight and the volume of the various food and drinks were. So, for example, if you're dealing with, let's say, in terms of weight, we're talking about, you know, there are light dishes, say, light salads, light vegetable dishes, and heavier dishes would be, you know, say, steak or game or venison. That's a little bit more intuitive. But in terms of volume, what we're talking about when we mean flavor volume is if you imagine the flavor of a dish as having, you know, it's either loud or quiet. It's sort of intuitive, you know, a quiet flavor would be something like white rice or chicken or tofu or something that's very neutral in flavor that sort of serves as a palate for showcasing other flavors. And a loud flavor would be just the opposite. Wasabi,
something like blue cheese, you know, something like that, or even a shot of Tabasco. That's where you're really getting into louder flavors, and that's, you know, again, those are bright, sharp flavors, and that's really sort of what they get your attention. They're loud.
See, I love that whole concept. I mean, as somebody who sees numbers as colors.
Well, let's suppose then that I have a low volume and a high volume. Do I want to plan a dish by saying, I only want to have one high-volume ingredient? Is that sort of the way it works?
Good question.
I think what you want to think about is, will my high-volume ingredient overpower my low-volume ingredient?
Okay.
So
gotcha.
If I have a nice piece of Dover sole, I might like a little bit of spice to that, but I don't necessarily want to throw in a bunch of fresh sliced jalapenos. That's going to overpower that light dish. So you sort of want to find the level that makes sense to your palate and also will also make... It's that the 1 + 1 = 3. So whatever you're going to add to that light Dover sole, and let's say it's a little bit of lemon, that's going to brighten the Dover sole, and it's going to brighten your palate. That's going to make a beautiful pairing, and that's going to make the two things add up to three.
Let me take a couple of examples that bring, because you've worked in the drink space as well, but maybe it's akin to the controversy that's going on as to whether or not you should drink red wine or white wine with cheese. Whether you should drink sweet white wine or red wine with foie gras.
Yes.
What kind of wine is appropriate to go with really spicy food? Do you want to put a big red up against it like a Zin, or do you want to say, no, that's not going to work, they're going to fight each other?
Well, the Zin will work as long as it's low tannin and has a lot of bright fruit to it.
Okay.
So you don't want to do a Cabernet, which is, you know, you have those big tannins, and that's absolutely going to fight with a spicy dish.
Okay. Anyway, I get the drift. Boy, I think I learned something today.
Before we get to how do you envision somebody using this book? That was what I was going to ask. Explain the chef's involvement and how you use the opinions of various chefs in this book.
Oh, that's a great question, because we have relied on the wisdom of America's leading chefs for our books. Our books, it's interesting, we do what you might think of as kind of a meta-analysis of taking a look at multiple opinions and gathering them together so that there's sort of a general consensus. You know, you can sort of think of it like the difference between having a single restaurant critic review a restaurant versus the Zagat survey, for example. You know, as insightful as that restaurant critic is, and as much as that critic might know about food and about the restaurant experience, and to be able to write up those opinions so eloquently, it's still just one opinion. And if someone tends not to like seafood and goes in to review a seafood restaurant, there's a bias at stake there. However, if you interview 100,000 restaurant goers, you'll have some that love seafood, some that hate seafood, and a bunch in between, and you'll get a consensus opinion that will be a little more well-rounded than a single opinion. So it's just different ways of looking at things. Our preference is to really interview dozens of some of the best minds in America's culinary world to find what that general consensus is of a group of dozens of chefs and experts to see what they think in terms of various flavor combinations. There may be someone on this earth that does not care for the combination of basil and tomatoes, but it's such a classic, and it is so strongly recommended by so many experts that we will list that particular combination in our book with not only boldface font, but also in all capital letters and with an asterisk next to it, which classifies it as one of what we call our holy grail pairings. That if you consider yourself a foodie, you really have to try this pairing at one point in your life because it's so extraordinary. And as you go through the book, you'll see that many of the recommendations are in bold or in bold caps or bold caps with an asterisk. And that really helps to underscore how strong the consensus is that this is truly an extraordinary pairing of flavors.
The other thing we wanted to do was interview a wide variety of chefs, in that we interviewed chefs who specialize in Italian cuisine, Indian cuisine, all across the board. So if you look up something like lamb, Vikram Vijas in Vancouver has one of the greatest Indian restaurants on the planet, is going to really turn this lamb into something Indian-inspired. He might braise it. He might actually, if you look up under lamb, you'll find a wine-marinated lamb, popsicle, and fenugreek, creamy curry, and spinach potatoes.
Wow.
So that's how Vikram Vijas is going to look at a piece of lamb versus someone like Dan Barber of Blue Hill, Stone Barns, and who's just outside New York. He's on the Rockefeller Estate. He's surrounded by, you know, these beautiful fields. And what Dan would do was lamb with stew of chickpeas, root vegetables, and braised lettuces.
Oh, wow.
Now, I just went to the farm on that dish, just reading it out loud. And I also went to India when I read Vikram's dish. So again, the more different voices we could bring in, the more inspiring we thought the book could be.
Now back to Anne's question, because
yes.
Before we wrap up the interview.
Who and how?
Yeah, who and how would use the book?
Oh, everybody. We really think that it's a little bit of a litmus test that as much cooking experience as you bring to the book, you will be able to use it in a completely different way. If you're a complete beginner, it's really sort of a, you know, cliff notes to thinking about flavor and to understanding flavor, and you can use it very literally. But for some of America's greatest chefs who are fans of the book because it spurs their creativity, it really takes them in a whole new direction to just look at a few combinations of flavors, and these experienced professional chefs are so talented that they can, you know, use it to generate a whole new dish, taking that combination, say, of salmon and horseradish, which is a classic and extraordinary combination. One chef will do it as a raw salmon with, a horseradish cream sauce, and another chef will take it in a completely different direction of grilled salmon with a completely different, you know, a horseradish sorbet served alongside it. You know, just finding ways to riff off of these successful flavor combinations that you can trust and to take them into whole new exciting directions.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I think that we all agree on the fact that this is a book that has to be on the shelf in your kitchen or wherever you keep your important reference books on food. It's congratulations on doing this. This is just an amazing, amazing book.
Oh, thank you.
So it's called The Flavor Bible. You can order it through the OTM bookshelf on our website. Andrew and Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I wanted one other question.
Go ahead.
I do that.
Of course you can.
I have two other questions.
You can have as many questions as you like.
My first question is, what are you working on next? Because this seems like a culmination.
Oh, well, we've always got a list of about 10 or 12 like to write next, and it's always a process of compromise to figure out where we're going to put our energies next. But we always try to be guided by the idea of what publishing world needs next.
Correct.
And we have some ideas about wine that we've developed over the last few years, and so we're actually going to be working on a wine book next. It's a little different from anything else that's out there, but we're very excited about it. And beyond that, we've got lots of other ideas about flavor that and how it's going to be changing in the years to come. And I think you'll see.
Oh, that's going to be interesting. Yeah, and then my second question is, coming from one husband and wife team to another, do you divvy up your responsibilities or do you combine efforts or what do you do?
Well, I think it's pretty organic. I think we both have different skills. They complement each other, fortunately. So I think it's, you know, everyone asks, like, how you write your books. I think every day it's new and different, but I will say it's fantastic being able to work with my wife and best friend, because that way on a harder day I can get a shoulder rub or share one with her.
I'm not getting shoulder rubs. No, wait a minute.
We need to negotiate that with your coworker.
Yeah, maybe.
Exactly.
Work up a new incentive plan over there.
Well, listen, it's been wonderful, and we've talked about doing this for a long time, and I'm glad we finally got around to having the interview, and I look forward to all of your books.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
And now we'll take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We look forward to your emails as always, on the menu at onthemenuradio.com, and visit our new blog, onthemenuradio.blogspot.com. And now we're moving into something that I never knew anything about, is how you devise new cultivations of apples.
New fruit. Can you imagine it's still possible to invent a new apple?
Well, and these apples are good, boy.
Well, David Bedford told us more about this process than we ever knew existed, and it's great to know that this wonderful work is going on.
And he's a delight.
So there.
Well, we've had a number of interesting guests on this program, but this is the first time for an apple breeder. And we're going to be talking to David Bedford from the University of Minnesota. Hello, and welcome to On the Menu, David.
Well, thank you. Pleased to be with you.
And David shared with us before we went on the air that growing up he hated apples, and he attributes the fact that he probably didn't eat very good apples, but the University of Minnesota seemed to us to be an odd entrant in the world of apple producing. But David, explain how this came about.
Yes, that's right. 100 years ago, our program began, exactly 100 years ago, in fact. We began because the apples that the settlers brought with them when they came to our part of the country were not hardy enough to live through the winters here. And so as all those died, there was enough of an upswell of interest in it that the state legislature funded a breeding program. For cold climates, yeah,
right.
that would find apples that could live in that climate. And we've done that, and now we've moved on to more than just cold climate breeding. We're really looking at high-quality fruit is our goal.
Now, where did the apples that survived come from? I mean, did you manage to get ones that could manage in Minnesota when people can't and cars can't start unless you plug the engine block heater in? Where did you find an apple that would survive like this?
Appleseed.
it was almost that way. Actually, some of them went back to Northern European, Russian roots, and then there were just a few that were available on the East Coast that weren't that good of quality, but were good and hardy. So that's always the dilemma that we start with in cold climate. We can find ones that are hardy usually, but they're not always that edible. And then the job is to cross the hardy ones with the edible ones and get something that has both.
Now you've got one of the leading programs perhaps in the world. You said there are only three in the United States altogether.
That's right.
And you've been at it for 100 years, and the reason that you're on the program is because someone thought of introducing us to your program because of a new apple that you've just launched, I guess is the right way to describe it.
Mm-hmm. It's called Sweet Tango.
Sweet Tango, that's right.
And it's an offspring of Honeycrisp, which is a favorite apple of mine. Mm-hmm. And it won't be really released until next October, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Now you said it took 30 years to develop Honeycrisp.
That's right.
And what about Sweet Tango? How long did it take?
Yes, Sweet Tango is actually I would say, the fastest one since I've been a breeder, and that was actually just a little over 20 years. So, it's sort of odd when you consider 20 years fast. But
now, how does it differ from Honeycrisp?
Well, first I'll tell you how it's similar. What we did was crossed Honeycrisp with Zestar, as you mentioned, and what we were hoping to get from Honeycrisp was its unique texture, that crisp breaking texture. We call it explosively crisp.
Yeah, no, that's what I like about these new apples.
Yes, and you're right. It did get that from its Honeycrisp parent. What we were hoping to get from the other parent, Zestar, was even a more intense flavor than Honeycrisp has. And indeed, that is what I think we are able to get from both parents. So how is it different? Very similar in texture, maybe a little harder, not quite as juicy maybe, but almost indistinguishable from Honeycrisp, but with more flavor, I think a more intense flavor.
Now, if we talk about what you do in terms of, you know, in terms of the layperson would understand,
mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that when you start to try to produce an apple that's hardy enough to survive, what you're doing is you're taking a rootstock that's known to be tough, and then you graft something onto it. Am I on the right path there?
Well, that we do that, but that's really not part of the breeding. The rootstock issue really is just a method of growing the tree. And in fact, until 10 years ago, all the trees that we grew were just on their own rootstock, basically, from our breeding program, that is. We switch now to a dwarf rootstock so we can put more trees in per acre. But the essence of what we do in the breeding is actually taking the pollen from one tree and putting it onto the flowers of another tree.
That was the next thing I was going to say. After the... No, what I thought you would be doing grafting, because that's what they do with vines, I guess, if they're looking for rootstock that will survive in unusual ground.
Yes.
So what you achieve is a
cross,
shall we say, as precise as you can, but obviously possibly since it takes 20 or 30 years to do it, then it's not exactly precise in terms of getting what you expect to get.
That's right. We're very precise in keeping track of the pollen and the flowers we use, but of course that only controls part of the equation, and it's much the same as even human or animal reproduction. You can choose two parents, and if those parents have 10 children, 100 children, whatever the number may be, each of those children will be unique individuals. So you've controlled the gene pool in the sense that you've chosen the parents, but you can't control the exact way those genes go together.
Okay. So when you taste it, and you said you're tasting 500 or 600 apples a day, not all of them, just taking a little taste
and spitting. Yeah. He said, like wine.
What you do is you keep track of each individual tree. And then the ones that have the apples that you really like, that's the one you go with.
That's right. In essence, what most of my job involves each day, day to day, is tasting these apples. As I said, about 500 or 600 a day, and then making a decision about that tree right then, if possible. Now that tree may have taken 6 or 7 years to come into bearing since I made the cross. But at that day, I'm trying to make a decision whether it goes on for further testing or gets discarded. And just to give you some sense of the ratio of trees that move on versus being discarded, every year I find somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 3,000 trees that don't make it. They get thrown away after tasting the fruit one time.
And the trees are uprooted and thrown away?
Yep, that's right.
Wow, okay.
That's sad.
Well, it's a sorting process, and most of them don't make it past that first sorting.
Uh-huh.
By the same token, in that same year that I've thrown away 2,000 to 3,000, I find about 10 to 15 that are worthy of going on to the next round of testing.
Wow, that's a lot of sorting, huh?
It's a lot of sorting, and most of it in a negative way. You know, most of what I taste each day gets thrown away on the spot.
How bad could it be, an apple?
Well, not that bad. That's right. In fact, if you were to walk down one of our long, long rows with me and tasted apples for an hour or so, you'd probably say, most of the ones we're throwing away, you'd say, well, that's not so bad. And that's not so bad. But I always say that if that's the best that you can say about that apple, then it's going to be discarded.
Okay, so you want one that really says something to you, and Sweet Tango is one of those.
Well, that, we think so, and in fact, even out of those 10 to 15 each year that get moved on to the next round of testing, most of those get tested for another 10 to 15 years. And most of those, 99% of those, get thrown away.
As well.
So by the time it's all done, we take a group of seedlings through the whole process. Only one out of about 10,000 of the original trees are good enough to go on to the next, or to be released and named, like Sweet Tango is.
Now, when they're named and released, then they can go to commercial producers, can then obtain them. Is that the way it works?
Right. Yeah. Once we take them through that process, we've thrown away the 9,999. The one goes forward. We give it a name. We patent it. We then send it to nurseries that are licensed with us to produce it, and it begins its sort of public life at that point.
Now, what do you send them? Do you send them pips?
Well, no. In this case, it would have to be shoots, cuttings from the tree.
Oh, okay, all right. So.
Because we have the same problem. Well, what's an advantage to us in the beginning when we plant those seeds out? The problem with seeds is they never come true to type.
Well, I was going to ask you about reverting to type, because I see this in my garden all the time. We plant arugula, and you get this nice little leaves, and then it seeds itself and it goes back to rocket with the serrated,
exactly,
which I like
right.
better anyhow. But
okay.
unfortunately, in the case of apples, you probably wouldn't like the resulting seedling as much as the original.
So the cutting is the secret. Huh?
That cutting is the secret, because in effect, a cutting is a clone. And once
that's what I was going to say. If they can clone a dog or a sheep, why can they not clone a tree?
Well,
and I guess that's
exactly
what they're doing.
Yeah, that's exactly what you're doing.
We think of cloning as something so new and scary and whatnot in animals and people, but in plants it's been done for thousands of years. It's as simple as grafting, which is what we're doing, or rooting a cutting, as you would with a house plant. So we want all that diversity that comes from seed propagation in the beginning. That's how we get the 10,000 trees to choose from. But when we find the one we want, then we want no deviations from that, and it's grafted from then on. Basically.
Okay, so a commercial apple grower will graft a cutting of Sweet Tango or whatever apple it is. They'll graft it onto one of their existing trees, so that it produces fruit a bit faster.
That's right. Or nurseries would do. They would actually graft it onto a rootstock.
Okay.
That would be appropriate for the climate. Or, in fact, actually, most rootstocks used in
Most rootstocks what?
Most rootstocks in the apple world are used to control the size of the tree. So when we talk about a dwarf apple tree, that's all because of the rootstock that was chosen.
Well, I have issues with these people selling dwarf trees. They end up not being dwarf at all.
We got a couple of rogues.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Well, and of course, the other thing that can happen with dwarf rootstock is if the tree is planted a little too deeply, and the rootstock gets buried completely, and the top of the tree, which is the Honeycrisp or the Sweet Tango, gets put slightly below the ground, it will form its own roots and then overgrow the effect of the rootstock. So that's a common problem that can occur.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
And it's not a totally unrelated subject, but at the other end of the scale of producing apples to cool climate apples is the history of the warm climate apple, the most famous being Granny Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always told that, in fact, this was actually named for a Mrs. Smith who owned a farm in outside Sydney in New South Wales, which is now home to the Randwick Racecourse, and that's how Granny Smiths were developed. Now, is that?
That's true. Or at least
that's really true.
That's the story I've always heard.
That's the story you heard too.
Yep, and in fact, the way she discovered it, as I understand it, was it had just sprouted in a compost pile of organic debris, and obviously some seeds had been thrown there from another apple, and up it grew.
And for some reason, it actually managed to thrive in a climate which is as inimical to apples as the Minnesota winters.
Yeah, that's probably
a
good,
you know,
analogy.
This is another example of what we were talking about is the reason you life, I can't remember what the term is, growers exert mm-hmm. control to maintain quality. Mm-hmm. I would say that the Granny Smith apples that come from Chile are not Granny Smith apples, by my mind. They do not taste as good at all as the stuff we had in Australia.
Yep, I have to agree that, and it's not just Chile. I mean, I think the variety has been ruined completely.
I do too.
Okay.
They're not like, we lived in the 70s in Australia, and these apples that they're selling as Granny Smith are not at all Granny Smith.
Yep.
They're terrible.
Well, this is the progression.
The color is even different.
That's right, yeah. And this is the progression that occurs in any apple that becomes very widely grown. It's a slow, steady downward spiral of quality, basically.
And you try to your program tries to stop that from happening.
Well, we try to, although when we release a variety freely to the world, we have no control over that. And so the new method that we're talking about and is being used in Europe as well is to have a managed variety, and that, in effect, controls where it's grown, how much is grown, the quality that would be sent to market. So basically just to protect the quality, as is pretty much done in every other commercial product in the world. You know, if you can imagine Kellogg's or some large, you know, cereal company introducing a new variety of cereal and then saying, but, you know, anybody that wants to make it, go right ahead and, you know, don't worry so much about quality control. Just make it and enjoy. And, of course, you would never do that with a commercial product. But
David, how do you get to be an apple breeder?
Well, my background is in horticulture. I studied biology originally and then into horticulture. And then it's just some breeding principles beyond that and a lot of field experience eating apples.
Yeah. And are you having a good time? You must be thrilled about Sweet Tango.
Well, yes. I mean, that's right. It's always fun when we get one that's that sort of hits all the bells, but I have to tell you that from day to day, I don't get to see the winners, so it's good to remember every now and then that all this eating and spitting and throwing away results in something good.
Now, Sweet Tango is not going to come to market until the end of the next apple growing season in October, so what variety?
October 2009.
Yeah, 2009. Next growing season.
Yeah. Yep.
So what are apples that people might look for that are in that sort of same quality bracket?
Honeycrisp.
Now. Well, yep. I want him to tell us.
I think the only one that I would put in that quality bracket would be Honeycrisp. Now, there's probably some other good apples out there that aren't as well known. But even Honeycrisp is still pretty rare in most markets. It's coming, but, you know, the other part of the little scenario that I didn't tell you was that it does take 20 to 30 years to develop a variety. It then takes usually 15 or 20 years for that variety to be commonly grown and to be known with any degree in the commercial market. So we're right at 17 years right now from when we introduced Honeycrisp. And there's still people in the U.S. that have never even heard of it. So
it in my farmer's market. They have it.
Yeah, and you're lucky. You're in a place that, you know, in Pennsylvania is a state that grows a good amount of apples. So you're lucky. But, you know, there's people in Florida and Texas and places like that are dependent on fruit being sent to them that probably haven't heard about it. So.
Well, this has just been an absolutely fascinating interview, David. It's
nice
to... we like to learn something every day. We like to learn something with every program. This is, quite honestly, this has been one of the most informative interviews I think we've ever had, and we certainly appreciate you joining us, and we hope you'll continue to keep up the good work.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure, and we'll keep working on... better apples for the world.
Now, we're actually looking for an apple called Bedford in the future. Is there going to be one?
Well, strangely enough, there is an old, I believe it's a Canadian apple named Bedford, but I wouldn't have chosen it to be my namesake if I had a choice.
We want the David Bedford Millennium Apple or something like that.
Well, that would be nice, but I'd have to say don't hold your breath.
Well, thank you so much, David.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Oh, we caught you napping there. Now it's now it's time to take a break. We'll see you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and here you are again, listening to On the Menu. We're having a good time talking to interesting people. Next up is a marvel of a writer.
Yeah, a returning guest, because James Peterson writes just absolutely the most incredibly carefully prepared, detailed, beautiful books. And when we came across sources, now in a recently published third edition, we just had to invite him back to the program.
Yeah, I mean,
to talk to us about it. The
first edition. And yeah, this is greatly expanded, as you will hear.
James Peterson, I don't know how you managed to turn out these encyclopedic books, but I'm so glad you do.
Yeah, they're not only encyclopedic, they also happen to be very good and very worth reading and referring to.
And they're beautifully written, so that you can actually, you've built in page turners to something that could be a very dry subject.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, you have a great style. Anyhow, the book we're talking about this go-around is Sauces, Classical and Contemporary Sauce Making, third edition. And before we went on the recording, I said to you, I believe that I have your first edition, which has served me very well from 20 years ago.
That's amazing. Yes, it has been almost 20 years now.
Yes. Now, what is the difference between that book, the first edition, and the second edition, which came out later, and now this third edition, which is over 600 pages? Very heavy, I might add.
Yes, it is. I know. That's the one inconvenience. Well, the second edition had a lot of information about Asian sauces.
Okay.
Everything, and just to back up a little bit, everything that's in each edition is included in subsequent editions. In other words, I didn't take anything out, and I didn't really modify anything that was already there. I just added things.
Uh-huh. So that's how it's so big. Mm-hmm.
Right. That's why it's so big. And the second edition, I added Asian sauces, which was quite extensive. I added a section about pasta sauces.
Which you have continued, yes.
And I added a section about wine, about pairing wines and sauces, and also a bibliography.
Okay.
Did they keep the bibliography for the third edition?
You haven't even bothered to look at it, Jim.
Well, I have. I just didn't look. I didn't notice the bibliography.
They do have.
Oh, that's good. That's good, because that was quite extensive. And then the third edition, there are more recipes for dishes that create their own sauces.
Oh, there you go. That's clever.
In other words, braised dishes and roasts and things where you make the sauce out of as a part of the process. And it came about because I had someone translating this book into French. We were going to publish it in French. And she said that it should be called The Art of Cooking Well. Because it was really a book more about cooking than about sauces.
Interesting.
So I kind of picked up that idea and went with it and made it a book, more of a general purpose cookbook.
Yeah, well, you have finished dishes. The recipes, I think, are going to be really welcome to people, and also gorgeous photographs of the finished
dishes.
Thank you. And, I mean, I don't think I'm braggy when I say that I've had a lifetime of exposure to food and cooking, but that every time I pick up the book and read it, I learn something new.
Oh, well, that's wonderful to hear.
Well, Anne, you have to understand, Anne reads cookbooks like Peter reads mystery novels. I was reading about a character in a book recently who said she read Jane Eyre. She'd read Jane Eyre at least 45 times. She read it at least once a year, whether she needed to or not.
Isn't that amazing? Well, that's a great book.
And I think your cookbook might be like that.
Oh, well, thanks.
Well, you know, I'm going to read something here because I thought this was kind of summed up this book. The quote from Jeremiah Tower, it says, "This is a book I wish I had written myself. Every few decades, a book is written that says all there is to say on a subject or has all the information and passion that sets the standard for professionals and amateurs alike. Sauces is one of the best culinary books of this century in English."
Now, that's isn't that a great quote?
Yeah, that's the, did you send him that as a suggestion, or did he come put
no,
it on?
No, I know. It's so great. I was so thrilled when I got that quote.
I mean, what else could you hope for, right?
No, I know.
But you were telling us before we went on the air that you've spent a lifetime in the kitchen, and you said you had a restaurant in France in the early 1980s?
Well, no, it was
in
New York.
Oh, New York. I'm sorry.
I wish it was in France. I've always dreamed of having a restaurant.
Then it was my... So it was a French restaurant in New York, not a New York restaurant in France.
Exactly.
I misunderstood what you said.
Yeah, we have... Who was it in Charleston? Bob Wagner.
Bob Wagner in Charleston actually owned a restaurant in France, which is a very rare thing to do. But you still have a day job now, correct?
Well, I still am writing and photographing books.
But don't you have a day job as well?
Don't you
Well,
teach?
Not really, no.
Not
but
really,
I think
okay.
I might be needing one.
Everybody does, right? So do you no longer teach?
Well, I teach sporadically. I just taught a class at the Institute of Culinary Education here in New York the other night. But I only teach on sort of an ad hoc basis when people ask me to.
Okay, that's where I got confused. I thought you had a full-time day job, and I was thinking that there must be 36 hours in each one of your days, that you sleep very few of those in order to be able to produce these wonderful volumes.
No, that's pretty much all I do is work on the books.
Now, what do you do when you're done with a book? Do you sort of sleep for a week?
Well, it's tricky because I need to make a living, so I have to keep generating book ideas.
Uh-huh.
I can't really take time off.
Well, this
book, they don't pay well enough.
Yeah, this is true about these books.
So, listen, that's a clue. If you want Jim Peterson to have bread on the table, you better buy his book. In fact, you better buy several copies and give one to all of your friends.
You better, yes. If you want to hear from me again, if I'm not somewhere slinging hash.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to mention a few of the chapters just to give people an idea of how thorough this book is. It is truly a reference book, and it's probably the only book anybody's ever going to need on sauces or on other aspects of cooking, because some of these chapters are, first of all, a short history of sauce making, which I found that fascinating. You have things like cooking in the Middle Ages and cooking in the 17th century, which is the century that likes capers. I thought that was interesting.
Oh, that comes about in the 16th century. They start cooking with indigenous things like capers and truffles and mushrooms and things.
Amazing. Then you have the next chapters on equipment and even including serving utensils. Then you move on to ingredients, and that category, not chapters, like Asian sauces, condiments, dairy products, herbs, mushrooms and truffles, nuts and seeds, pork products, spices, spirits, wine, and other ingredients. I couldn't even add to that list. I mean, it's amazing. Then you do stocks, glazes, and essences, liaison, an overview, and like how many different kinds you have, white sauces, brown sauces, stock-based and non-integral fish sauces, integral meat sauces. I mean, this is amazing. To mayonnaise, I mean, it's like vinaigrettes, butter sauces. It's just absolutely amazing, including desserts.
Well, thank you. One chapter I'm particularly fond of that people kind of look over because they assume the worst is the jellies and chauffeur chapter.
Oh, yeah? Tell us about that.
Because most people, I hate them because they think of aspic, you know? They think of those horrible aspic dishes.
Uh-huh.
Which we used to get in the 50s where everything was in jello.
Oh, I hated that, yes.
Those were just awful. And I've written a chapter in which I talk about making natural jellies, where it's just the natural outcome of cooking something. And they're some of the most delicious sauces, if you would, that there are around.
Right, and you have a contemporary take on all of this, which is even more valid.
Exactly. It's a very contemporary take, especially on that subject.
Now, you also came up with some great ideas for preserving herbs and things, too.
Yes, I like to preserve herbs in vinegar or oil.
Right.
You can freeze them to some degree, and some herbs dry okay.
I just tried, I had sort of a surplus of fennel, and so I just cut off the stems, and I washed them, patted them dry, and froze them on a cookie sheet like you would berries.
Uh-huh.
And they froze, and I just collected them and put them in a plastic freezer bag, and I'm just going to pull off bits of it for seasoning.
Because we haven't tried that yet, listeners, so...
I'm not sure it's going to work.
Before you start experimenting with that, be sure to send us an email.
I find that fennel is wonderful in stalks.
I always used
to use the fennel stalks, so to speak, in the stalk, because it gave it a lovely kind of freshness without overtaking it.
Exactly.
I didn't know. Are you familiar with that?
I discovered that
and was really pleased with the results. Or using them as an aromatic vegetable when you braise to put fennel in there.
I grew up with the Sicilian cooking, so that's what we did.
Oh, okay.
Lots of fennel.
But I never thought of putting one in a braise, though.
Oh, yeah, you do.
Well, I don't know anything.
And then
I just read the recipes. I'm going to have to read this book. I love making one sauce braised dishes that will hopefully last for several days at a time, because it makes time spent in the kitchen a little more economical.
Yes, it is. I like making roasts and braised dishes too, for that reason.
Now, here's a question: Why is it that braised dishes like that, why do they always taste better on the second day and even better on the third day? Do you know the reason for that?
Well, I think part of it is psychological. I think just being away
from it's the relief of not having to cook.
Just being away from the smells of it. You know, when you walk into a house and you smell that smell for the first time, how delicious it smells. Mm-hmm. And whereas if you've been submerged in it all day, immersed in it, it's not so delicious.
Okay, but there isn't a chemical reason behind that that you
know. Well, there may be. If there is, I don't know what it is.
What absorbs the flavors and integrates them better.
Well, now we're going to test this book now, because one of the tests I know will pass, because Anne said there's a great recipe in there for skate. And the only thing we have to do is find another source of supply for skate, because our fish shop doesn't stock it anymore.
You can probably use any kind of fish.
In fact, I
like skate.
Well, we use Rick Stein's recipe.
Mm-hmm. Rick Stein, I like his book.
Yeah, we like his book, and we particularly like his skate preparation, and I have done it with several different kinds of fish. But here's the test, and it's a test that I can't know. You'll know, and I won't, because I haven't looked it up. Do you have a recipe in there for tongue?
Tongue? I don't know if I do. You know, I get confused with what I have in what book. Because I know I have tongue in my new book.
Okay, tell us what the new book is, because I was going to ask you that anyhow.
Well, the book I'm working on now, I actually have a baking book coming out next year.
Okay.
But I'm working on a book, I almost said a tongue book. I'm working on a meat book.
Uh-huh.
Which includes all the major cuts and all the basic cooking techniques for all the major cuts.
Yeah, we had this fascinating adventure because we got a beef tongue as part of a deal, as part of a cow that we bought. And we only have maybe 600 cookbooks or something like that in our possession at any one time. And Anne said, I know I saw a recipe for tongue. What book was it in?
I might have a recipe in my French book. I'm trying to remember.
Okay.
We found it in Anne Willen's book.
Yeah, we found it in Anne Willen's Country French Cooking.
It might be
in one of your other books, which we have.
I made tongue recently. I made a bolito misto.
Oh, that would have been
And I had a tongue in there. That tongue, I love tongue.
I do, too, and I never liked it growing up because, it had other kind of emotional connotations, but I found out all of a sudden I just adore it.
Yeah, we couldn't have enough of it. We said, why didn't we buy a bigger tongue, and where can we get the next one?
Well, it was grass-fed beef too, so those.
Yeah, different. Maybe that's. I thought it was to do with my wonderful preparation.
I think it was. So you work on multiple books at a time, Jim?
No, I pretty much go one by one.
Okay.
So which is next, the meat book?
So the meat book is the one I'm working on now.
Oh, great. Okay, well, I can hardly wait for that one.
But I'm looking in the index of my French book to see if there's any tongue listed in there.
Okay, because we might have seen it. We may have that book, and we didn't realize it was in there.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there, because I like it. There's a tongue I do with Madeira that's quite delicious.
That sounds good. That sounds really, I like anything with Madeira.
Well, when's this one coming out? When's the meat book coming out?
Well, it'll be coming out in 2010.
Okay. Great. Well, we will.
Oh, here it is. I'm redeemed.
You're redeemed.
Yes, tongue braised, 551. Let's see here. If you have my French book, which incidentally is my favorite of my books.
Yeah, I'm not sure I do.
It'll be in there.
Can you still get it?
Oh yeah, it's in print.
Okay.
I mean, you probably have to order it. I don't see it around much.
Mm-hmm.
It came out the day we invaded Iraq.
I see.
So that was a kind of a down moment.
So the timing couldn't have been absolutely worse. It was the very week where they were talking about freedom fries and all that anti-French stuff.
Oh, my God.
But there is a braised tongue in it. There's a whole section about tongue, actually.
Well, listen, hey.
Is it the same publisher? Can I?
Yes, it is. The same publisher. It's Wiley.
Wiley. I have good relations with them. I'll get that.
It has a terrible picture of me on the cover.
Oh, dear. I have not seen it.
The cover picture is just terrible. I just hate it. I look like they put me in a coffin and took me out again.
Oh, jeez.
Well, Jim, I think you're going to have to get this meat book coming out really fast because we're going to need even more to know about how to cook the lesser cuts of meat.
Since our household
budget is going to have to shrink like everybody else's.
Oh, right. You'll be living on tripe.
I like tripe.
You said you didn't like tripe.
I don't. I mean, there's nothing about tripe except the sauces.
She doesn't.
That's a good segue, anyhow.
She really doesn't like tripe. Anyway, James, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Keep in touch, Jim.
Yeah.
Well, I will. It's hard for me. I get confused. I lose email numbers and all that stuff.
It's all downhill ahead of you, believe me.
But if you'd pop me an email, I would sure appreciate it once in a while.
We absolutely will.
The
next one will come when we know this interview is on the air so the listeners can tune in. And the book is called Sauces, and then it's got a subtitle.
Classical and Contemporary Sauce Making, Third Edition. That edition is important, Third Edition.
But I know if you put Sauces into Amazon.com, you can find it, but just for convenience, because I just put it on our website.
It's on our website, yeah.
It's on the menu bookshelf section, and we hope you'll all take advantage of that link to get your own copy, because aside from the wonderful recipes, it's also terrific for building arm and shoulder muscles.
All right. So have a good rest of the day.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, most people assume that the best thing about this job is that we get to eat all this fabulous food. In fact,
and that is a side benefit, I guess you might call it.
Yeah, I mean, what I like about it is we get to talk to so many interesting and accomplished people.
And I hope that you enjoy listening to them too. Presumably,
yes.
That's why you come to On the Menu Radio. And of course, we'll hope to welcome you back same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.